Welcome to the conversation.org, making sense of these times web radio program.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great. Hear that click.
You're listening to the first of our series of Suzanne's reading from Brian Swim's The Universe is a Green Dragon. We would love to hear from you. Email us at suzanne@mightycompanions.org. And now, here she is, Suzanne Taylor.
I'm the number one fan of a book called The Universe is a Green Dragon, a cosmic creation story, it says in fine print, by Brian Swim, a physicist turned cosmologist. Cosmologists are concerned with how science measures with other ways of knowing wholeness so that we get a bead on ourselves in the biggest universe, in the biggest picture. And I'm reading this to you thinking that we're kind of, sitting around a campfire, and we're taking a trip together to link up with this canopy of stars overhead and with one another, whereby we actually feel the enormous good luck of there being a planet Earth, and get a sense of a passion for serving it and one another. Now, this book came out in 1985, and I've written on the inside cover a wondrous map for how to understand ourselves, the journey of the hero. In fact, it has been my journey for the last 15 years. This is my guidebook. This is the one that places me in the opening position, you might say, from which to lead my life, understand who I am, see what I am here to do. And it is also the only book that I've read several times, so that as I read it each time, I go through and find places to mark that I didn't find before. It's virtually every sentence is markable. I think, how come I didn't mark this incredible passage? Well, I'm going to try to animate all of this for you and bring my enthusiasm to you, because I think this book is the prescription for what ails this world, and that if everyone were to read it, that would be the beginning of the cure. It starts with a prologue. Brian says, I was presenting some new ideas on the new cosmology at a conference in Chicago when suddenly a woman charged out of the audience, upset, eyes flashing as if Athena herself had decided to confront me. I want you to explain to me why my son isn't taught this in high school. You say scientists have thrown out the materialistic worldview. Then why should my son suffer it at all? And it concerns more than our high schools. I used to wonder something similar when I taught mathematics and physics at the university level. I was supposed to introduce students to the universe. The universe. But I was not to speak of meaning. Doesn't that seem like a strange assignment? If you persist in such questioning, the answer is not hard to find. Our modern Western civilization began with a kind of cultural schizophrenia. Our scientific enterprise effectively decoupled itself from our humanistic spiritual traditions at the beginning of the modern period. All for good reasons, yes, but now the neurosis spreads over several continents. Now, this is Descartes, I presume he's talking about, whom we all know as the original culprit who split matter from spirit and made them separate studies. Well, we're going to weave them back again here. Enmeshed in the most terrifying pathology in the history of humanity. Now, isn't that a line? The most terrifying pathology in the history of humanity. This is a very strong statement Brian is making. This is not a gentle book, even though it's the sweetest book you've ever read. But he's calling spades spades. He's saying the situation is quite dire now. Enmeshed in the most terrifying pathology in the history of humanity, we can perhaps dare to ask if this was such a good idea, this splitting up of the universe. Alert humans could see the danger of our situation from the beginning. Although they could not have predicted the planetary poisons that beset us, nor the threat of annihilation that everyone carries to bed every night of the week, They could see that we were headed for an unhealthy future. Diseased mindscapes only produce diseased landscapes, but there was nothing anyone could do about it. The sciences were effective in their mechanistic formulations and thus became entrenched in mechanism. Our religious tradition carefully retreated into a redemption orientation and concluded creation, with a capital C, was not its concern. So it was saving humanity, not attuning us to the beautiful sacred source from whence we come. Brian goes on, Western culture put itself on tracks that led to an inescapable and ever-deepening sickness. Now that's one of the most recent lines that I marked. I just thought it summed everything up so well. Western culture put itself on tracks that led to an inescapable and ever-deepening sickness. Aha, we took a turn. But something tremendous is occurring in our time, something with the power to break up this impasse. I mean the radical transformation of our fundamental worldview as the cosmic story of our origins and development take hold in human awareness. When I say our origins and development, I mean more than the human species. I mean the origin and development of the universe as a whole. We have discovered something with overwhelming possibilities. The universe can no longer be regarded as a result of chance collisions of materials, nor as a deterministic mechanism. Now, this is important. This is the difference now. We've learned through what science has actually told us, but in this last century, that the old view isn't consistent, that the view we hold, that we are a result of chance collisions of materials, deterministic mechanism, it just goes on by some order that happens to be in it. But instead, Brian goes on, the universe, considered as a whole, is more like a developing being. The universe has a beginning and is in the midst of its development, a vast cosmic epigenesis. Everything that exists is involved in this emergence, galaxies and stars and planets and light and all living creatures. How does this deeper understanding empower us? By enabling us to reinvent the human within the new cosmic story. Nothing less will suffice. A new sociological viewpoint or a new psychological theory is inadequate to deal with the magnitude of our concerns. We need to understand the human within the intrinsic dynamics of the Earth. Alienated from the cosmos, imprisoned in our narrow frames of reference, we do not know what we are about as a species. We will discover our larger role only by reinventing the human as a dimension to the emerging universe. Well, this is the whole secret to unlocking us from this contracted position in which we're struggling for personal survival and attuning us to this much larger picture, which is actually enlivening us. It's the energy of who we are as we're occupying one room in this grand mansion. So Brian is going to bring us out of this contraction into this larger space, and it's our new beginning. So the introduction ends with a couple of paragraphs. He makes a break now and explains, what I present in the pages of this book is the overall picture of the cosmic creation story, told in a single evening's conversation. I call the two speakers Thomas and Youth. By Thomas, I want to honor Thomas Berry, to whom this book, by the way, is dedicated, and the cosmological tradition he celebrates, stretching back from Eric Jantz and Teilhard de Chardin through Thomas Aquinas to Plato. The idea to present the new creation story in the form of a conversation originated at the Broadway diner in New York City. I was working my way through a Greek salad. Oh, this is quintessentially Brian Swim, who's also just the most magnificent person. I mean, I hope it's not a blasphemy to read his words, because he would read them just, oh, captivatingly. He's a captivating person who lives inside this incredibly imaginative story that he's telling us in ways we've never heard it before. Not only is there new scientific knowledge coming up to ground us in a new perspective, but a visionary, mystical, poetic sense that Brian has of how all the hardcore scientific facts translate into beautiful, artful, inspirational energetics of being itself that will infuse your being as you tune in to him. Here's this hunky, gorgeous man, 6'4", 5'6", something, and just the loveliest person you'd ever want to meet, telling you that the idea to present the new creation story in the form of conversation originated at the Broadway Diner in New York City. I was working my way through a Greek salad when Thomas Berry suddenly said, "You scientists have this stupendous story of the universe. It breaks outside all previous cosmologies, but as long as you persist in understanding it solely from a quantitative mode, you fail to appreciate its significance. Of course, science is all about measuring, carving up, and then pasting back as if all is the proper accumulation. But we're not just accumulation. Something else runs through us that can't be broken up." So back to Brian. "You fail," and Thomas Berry speaking here, "you fail to hear its music. That's what the spiritual traditions can provide. Tell the story, but tell it with a feel for its music." Then Brian says, "I call the other human youth to remind us that the human species is the youngest, freshest, most immature, newest species of all the advanced life forms in the planet. We have only just arrived. If we can remain resilient, if we can continue our questioning, our developing, our hoping, if we can live in awe and in the depths of wonder, we will continue moving into the only process that now matters, our authentic maturation as a species. It is in this way and only this way that we will enable the earth to bloom once again." So here we are with our task, our challenge, the only process that now matters, our authentic maturation as a species. Well, we are maturing, he has told us. We're not just here, some accident that got created, going about our ways. We are in a process, and it can be proved to us, shown to us, gotten into our fiber of our being as we open our minds, and then, of course, our hearts, to understand this larger, glorious picture in which we are a pulsing, developing, most advanced and awesome, in fact, possibly the most awesome thing in the entire cosmos, because life itself, as you will come to understand, is such a miraculous combination of factors, we may indeed be the only ones. But with that mystery probably ever unsolvable, unless, of course, we find the others, another kind of topic, we are going to now find ourselves. So we start the book, which is divided into three sections, with section one, Cosmos as Primary Revelation. And then there are subsections inside each section. And the first subsection is called Creativity, Primordial and Pervasive. So this is where we begin. That the cosmos is in a revelatory aspect. It springs from nothing. So, cosmos as primary revelation, creativity, primordial and pervasive. Youth asks, "Why do you say the universe is a green dragon?" Thomas says, "I'm a storyteller. Besides, it seems an appropriate way to begin the new story of the cosmos. But why say it's a green dragon when it obviously isn't?" "For several reasons. I call the universe a green dragon to remind us that we will never be able to capture the universe with language." "How can you be certain of that?" because the universe is a singularity. To speak, you need to compare things. Thus, we say that the house is white, not brown, or that the man is hostile, not kind, or that it happened in the 19th century, not before. But there is only one universe. We cannot compare the universe with anything. We cannot say the universe. I call the universe a green dragon because I want to avoid lulling you into thinking we can have the universe in our grasp, like a stray dog shut up in its kennel. I want to remind us of this proper relationship as we approach the whole of things. And he has that capitalized, the whole of things. Ah, yes, this is all about the whole of things. On the other hand, Thomas goes on to say, and here is a second reason for the green dragon, we have learned things in our scientific explorations that completely transform our understanding of the universe. Our revolution in thinking dwarfs Copernicus's announcement that the Earth travels around the sun. It is outrageous to compare the universe to a green dragon, I know, but I hope this will express some of my astonishment at what we now know about the universe. Wow. I mean, this Copernicus guy was the one that we know changed everything. Now, so this is more important than that? Whoa! Thomas, the inadequacy of the dragon image is that green dragons are much too commonplace to indicate the radical nature of what we have learned. That's how limited our language is. So, shall we begin? You're going to tell me the story of the universe? What better way to spend an afternoon in the gracious presence of the Hudson River? You must be ready for some confusion. Much of what you hear will perplex you. Interrupt me whenever you wish to stop and reflect on something. Only by doing so will you come to hear the story in a significant manner. Only then can you begin to feel the magnitude of what is breaking into human awareness. Will this take a long time? No, it will be done before the sun sets, and it's already over Hawaii. Pour yourself some apple juice. When things get difficult, remember the stupendous red oak. It's been here some 400 years. Think of what it has lived through. Think of its patience, its perdurance, its continued vitality, as it has learned to interact with all that came its way. And yet, here it is. Its presence will help us through some of the rugged passages ahead. Where shall we start? At the beginning. We need to start with the story of the universe as a whole. Our emergent cosmos is the fundamental context for all discussions of value, meaning, purpose, or ultimacy of any sort, our emerging cosmos. Now, this is what's new, scientifically. We are emerging, not fixed. To speak of the universe's origin is to bring to mind the great silent fire at the beginning of time. Now, this is what we emerge from, folks. Imagine that furnace out of which everything came forth. This was a fire that filled the universe, that was the universe. There was no place in the universe free from it. Every point in the cosmos was a point of this explosion of light. And all the particles of the universe churned in extremes of heat and pressure. All that we see about us, all that now exists, was there at the beginning, in that great burning explosion of light. How do we know about it? We can see it. We can see the light from the primeval fireball, or at least the light from its edge, for it burned for nearly a million years. We can see the dawn of the universe because the light from its edge reaches us only now, after traveling 20 billion years to get here. We can see the actual light from the fireball. When you see a candle's flame, you see the light from the candle. In that sense, we see the fireball. We are able to interact physically with photons from the beginning of time. So we're in direct contact with the origin of the universe? That's right. I can't believe I didn't know this. Scientists have only just learned to see the fireball. The light has always been there, but the ability to respond to it requires a tremendous development of the human senses. Just as an artist learns to see a lakeshore's subtle shades and contours, the human race learns to develop its sensitivities to what is present. Learns. It took millions of years to develop, but humans can now interact with the cosmic radiation from the origin of the universe. We can now see the beginnings of time, a stupendous achievement. It's amazing. Most amazing is this realization that everything that exists in the universe came from a common origin. The material of your body and the material of my body are intrinsically related because they emerged from and are caught up in a single energetic event. Our ancestry stretches back through the life forms and into the stars, back to the beginnings of the primeval fireball. This universe is a single, multi-form, energetic unfolding of matter, mind, intelligence, and life. What a sentence. And all of this is new. None of the great figures of human history were aware of this. How do you like that? Science is telling us now that we had a Big Bang and that we are just the extension of it. It's all still here. We didn't know this until the last century. And all these wise people who tuned in to the workings, such as when we tune in to our inner self, we know they were on the beam. It's the beam, regardless of whether we could describe it or not. And these people who knew without this confirmation, he says, going on to read Thomas, not Plato or Aristotle or the Hebrew prophets or Confucius or Thomas Aquinas or Leibniz or Newton or any other world maker. We are the first generation to live with an empirical view of the origin of the universe. Hey, come on, folks. This is hot. We are the first humans to look into the night sky and see the birth of stars, the birth of galaxies, the birth of the cosmos as a whole. Our future as a species will be forged within this new story of the world. But what about my future? What difference will it make for me? Asks youth. Well, to begin with, you will have to embrace your creative potential. Whoa. The universe has unfolded to this point. It has poured into you the creative powers necessary for its further development. The journey of the cosmos depends on those creatures and elements existing now, you among them. For the unfolding of the universe, your creativity is essential as the creativity inherent in the fireball. Now, isn't this interesting? Here we are already starting to feel this majesty and this work at hand. We're not just kind of hanging out. We have work to do. Now, they're going to really help us to figure out how. Youth asks, how can I learn about my creativity? Consider the creativity acting throughout the universe, Thomas says. Look there. And you will begin to understand how that same creative activity gathers you into its work as well. The fireball was a cauldron of creativity. In it were created all the elementary particles of the universe. All that exists on Earth exists only through the elementary particles that emerged in that first epoch of the universe's unfolding. After the fireball, stars and galaxies were created. We must realize that the creation of a galaxy is one stupendous activity. Could we manage that? Yet, galaxies were created by the 100 billion, each with its 100 billion stars. You know, you start to wrap your mind around this, the size of this, which of course is infinite also. But these numbers, I don't know, million, billion, I don't know, whatever it is, it's so incomprehensible. But now we're getting a track. Back to Thomas. And all of it dances, the stars swirling about each other, exploding, creating new stars, holding each other in the silence of the gravitational embrace. And these stupendously complex systems of being simply leapt into existence. Here's our science of today. This is chaos theory. we leap into existence from nothing. Okay. When we reflect on the creativity inherent in the universe, we are overwhelmed both by its enormity and by its seeming effortlessness. To learn about creativity, we must begin to understand the creativity of Earth. We know of no other planet with Earth's creative power. I speak now of Earth as a whole, as a creative entity. Earth created the land masses. Isn't this beautiful? This is Gaia, of course. But just think of this being of Earth, giving forth with all that is on itself. Earth created the land masses, the mountain ranges, the atmosphere. The Moon and Mercury created mountain ranges, but their creativity ended long ago. Mars, too, created mountains and a thick crust and an atmosphere, but its significant creative evolution has ceased. The Earth, on the other hand, will continue to create for billions of years. Jupiter certainly created an atmosphere, but Jupiter will never be able to bring forth a continent. Its great mass will remain gaseous far into the future. Only on Earth were the creative dynamics able to fashion such diversity, even on this elemental realm. Earth created the oceans, a stupendous feat. We have yet to find another ocean in this galaxy, another lake or river. We know of no others besides our own. None? Asks youth. We found water vapor and ice, but that is all. Now listen to this. The creation of ice is a profound enough manifestation of creativity. There was no ice in the first billions of years of the universe. Or to have created water vapor, as did Venus, certainly reveals creative dynamics at work. But to have created the oceans and to have maintained them for 4 billion years, oh God, does it make you cry at the pollution that we are producing on our planet after we maintain these oceans for 4 billion years? It's an accomplishment of which only Earth can boast. For all we know, there may be no other planet that has shown such creative power. An alarming thought, perhaps, but one that must be considered seriously until we have evidence indicating otherwise. Good old youth, oceans seem so ordinary, says he. Yes, they do, but that only reflects the ordinariness of our minds. When we take the whole universe as our fundamental frame of reference, we begin to appreciate the cosmic significance of running water. Only by establishing ourselves within the unfolding cosmos as a whole can we begin to discover the meaning and significance of ordinary things. Earth was a cauldron of chemical and elemental creativity, fashioning ever more complex forms and combinations until life burst forth in the oceans and spread across the continents, covering the entire planet. This creativity advanced until flowers bloomed on every continent, then advanced further until the vision of the flowers and all beauty could be deeply felt and appreciated. We are the latest, the most recent, the youngest extravagance of this stupendously creative Earth. So how do you like that? We went from creating the masses, like oceans and planets, to where we created the appreciator of the whole process, which is us. We're the only ones with self-reflexive awareness in the whole animal kingdom, so that we can turn around and contemplate our own existence and the beauty of it. You says, are we the last extravagance of this stupendously creative Earth? Thomas says, we haven't even begun. How can you speak of an ending? We are only just starting out on the human adventure, and are only too keenly aware of our immaturity. Even this discussion reveals the way in which the human self-reflexive mind continues to unfold. Only minutes ago, you were unaware of the primeval fireball. The entire species was unaware of the fireball's light for millions of years. Do you see? The universe continues to unfold, continues to reveal itself to itself through human awareness. So here we are, sitting around the campfire. Did you know that there was this primeval fireball? Well, of course, we do know about the Big Bang. Youth is a tabula rasa. He knows nothing. But haven't we already learned some placement of ourselves, that we are the continuing evolution of that? Come on, We're still stuck in the old dynamics of a deterministic universe. So here's the new news. Youth asks, when you talk about how the oceans emerged, I can see that that is an obvious addition to the Earth. But what do humans add that is actually new? Well, he's already answered this, but he's going to, of course, answer again. And this is such a beautiful sentence. The human provides the space in which the universe feels its stupendous beauty. I love that sentence. Think of it this way. Before the human arrived, the Earth and universe were magnificent realities. However, some of the depths of this magnificence were yet to be felt, yet to be appreciated. We enabled some of the depths of the universe to be tasted, and we have only just begun our venture. Much waits on our maturity. Why else do all things of the earth keep calling to the humans, hoping to feel their existence in an intensely felt living of life? Isn't that the truth? Don't you just feel you want an intensely felt living of life? It's a pull. You want to be in life. Thomas says, think of it. Even yesterday, you did not allow the fireball entrance into your awareness. Now that you have heard, aren't you filled with its wonder? Well, yes. Very. Now, here's another beautiful sentence from Thomas. The universe shivers with wonder in the depths of the human. Do you see? Think of what it would be like if there were no humans on the planet. The mountains and the primeval fireball would be magnificent, but the earth would not feel any of this. Can you see the sadness of such a state? The incompleteness? I sometimes think the primary deed of a parent is to see the beauty and grace of children. Children are magnificent, gorgeous beyond telling. They themselves have no idea what beauty they embody. Can you see the tragedy of a child with no one to feel and cherish its beauty? No one to fall in love with this magnificent creature. No one to celebrate its splendor. And of course, this is the world that we could be creating, where all the children grow up with this sense of their splendor, but we've got to get it to pass it on. Thomas continues, the cosmos is the same. Humans can house the tremendous beauty of Earth, of life, of the universe. We can value it, feel its grandeur. And you're saying we haven't finished this work? Each of the 3 years of humanity has achieved its own unique vision of beauty. So we have 3 eras we're going to hear about now. During the tribal shamanic age, the great mysteries of earth and sky and sun burst into human consciousness. Think of what that must have been like, to have lightning sear the human mind for the first time. Thunderstorms fill human feeling. Whenever we are moved to awe by the branching fire of lightning, whenever we tremble with expectation in the pre-dawn forest, we are remembering the earth's first taste of its own beauty. Oh, doesn't that sound attractive? You be in the shamanic period, tribal shamanic, you have your lovely tribe that loves you, but of course you wouldn't have plumbing. Okay, so let's see where the second period is. In the second era of human history, that of the great classical civilizations, yes, I think they did have plumbing, actually. Well, but they didn't have television. We witnessed the rise of the Chinese, the Indian, the European, the Middle Eastern, and the Amerindian. By enabling humans to specialize in their work, civilizations brought forth human powers unimagined in the tribal world. In this matrix, the great scriptures of the world were written, the classical spiritual disciplines forged. During this period of human history, there developed an appreciation for the human world as the intersection of the transphenomenal and phenomenal realms. So now we're getting the picture of things in this differentiation that's no longer tribal, where everyone is somewhat the same, but now we are creating a complex civilization. Now, what about third? Okay, he goes on. The scientific technological era is humanity's third phase of development. In these last few centuries, we have empirically penetrated the dynamics governing the Earth and the cosmos. The gravitational, the electromagnetic, the weak and strong nuclear interactions were discovered and encoded in mathematical language. The power to alter the Earth's dynamics through technological inventions was seized. Aha, good and bad. The immensity of time and space dawned within the human awareness, and even the origins of the universe burst into the individual self-reflexive awareness. The scientific technological period has enabled the dynamics of the universe to unfold in human consciousness. And then, here we are, he says, at present the human species moves into its fourth era, which we might call the age of the Earth, capitalized Earth. This does not mean that science or technology will evaporate. The tribal shamanic era did not disappear when classical religious civilizations emerged, nor did these civilizations all disappear when the scientific technological era began. But the creative fire within the human venture now focuses on bringing forth something entirely new, a form of human life that envisions itself within the interconnected dynamics of the unfolding Earth reality. The tribe will not be the center of the human world, nor will the civilization, the culture, nor the nation-state. It will be the Earth community as a whole that will be understood as our home, our womb of creativity and life. So we're going to shift our focus now from all of this exterior formful reality in which we live, the nation-state, the culture, and we're going to shift our lens, our entry point, our starting place, to understanding that the Earth community as a whole, everything of which we are a part, is our home, our womb of creativity and life. He goes on, humans will demand a deeper awareness of the planetary and cosmic dimensions implicit in self-reflexive mind. From the planet's point of view, we can say that the Earth is awakening to its own beauty, power, and future possibilities. Isn't that a lovely thought? From the planet's point of view, that planet that gave rise to oceans and mountains, what's happening on the planet, to the planet, the Earth is awakening to its own beauty, power, and future possibilities. The Earth awakens to the unfolding vision of a self-aware entity. It awakens in the unfolding vision of us. That's me, not Brian, about the unfolding vision of us. Youth asks, the Earth is a person? No, the Earth awakens through the human mind. Ah, he's taking care of you. You have to understand this from two different points of view. We have a humanity that awakens to its planetary dimension, to its planetary responsibility, and thus begins to provide the Earth with a heart and mind. From the other perspective, we can see how the planet as a whole awakens through the self-reflexive mind, which happens to unfurl through humanity. The youth asks a great question. Does everyone know about this? The great spasms of confusion that torture so many of us in this time are manifestations of some degree of awareness of our situation. Despair and fear are ways in which many people reveal the repressed awareness that something of immense proportions is taking place on Earth. You say we're leaving the scientific technological era. What happens to science and technology then? During the scientific technological period, we regarded technology as a way of improving the human lot. We regarded science as knowledge that humanity had gathered concerning the universe. But during the age of the Earth, we will learn to see both science and technology as activities of the Earth. There were plant technologies on this planet for hundreds of millions of years before the emergence of humans and similar scientific knowledge throughout the biological world. Or did you think that weather forecasting was a human invention? We will begin to understand that science and technology have emerged to serve the planet's unfolding, to enhance the total fabric of Earth's reality, and not merely to serve us. You see, humanity is a creation of the Earth process. We were brought forth to enrich the total life of the planet with our science and technology and everything else. But what can I do? How am I supposed to help out? Oh my God, we could all ask this question, right? Don't get impatient. You have to learn first. Oh God, there's hope. We can learn. Just moments ago, the presence of the universe's origin was unknown to you. Be patient, for there is certainly specific work waiting for you. Or did you think that the universe went to 20 billion years of work to create you if there was not a particular function that you, and only you, could do? The creative powers residing in you will be evoked in time for the work they were created for. Well, that sentence does make me cry. Please, God, from Brian's writing to God's ears, the creative powers residing in you will be evoked in time for the work they were created for. This is a matter of deep faith, is it not? Because I grow old. But this is it. Here I am. Here we are. What creative powers? Asks youth. We cannot say until they show themselves. Not even you could know yet. But where do they come from, then, if even I don't know where they are? From the same place that everything comes from the same place out of which the primeval fireball comes, an empty realm, a mysterious order of reality, a no-thingness that is simultaneously the ultimate source of all things. Now, wait a minute, says youth. I realize how strange it sounds, but there is little we can do about that. I'm speaking here of something that has recently been encountered empirically. In the language of physics, we call it quantum fluctuation. Elementary particles fluctuate in and out of existence. What a strange realization. Don't think that physicists have any easier time of it than you. Elementary particles leap into existence, then disappear. A proton emerges suddenly. Where did it come from? Who made it? How did it sneak into reality all of a sudden? We say it simply leapt out of no-thingness. There was no particle, then there was. I am not speaking here of the manner in which mass and energy can be transformed into one another. I am speaking of something much more mysterious. I am saying that particles boil into existence out of sheer emptiness. That is simply the way the universe works. We have to get used to it. We didn't construct it. We just find ourselves here. If elementary particles are going to come leaping out of mysterious realms, then that's the way it is. Well, I have this section underlined, all the different colors of my various read-throughs each time I've read this book. This is such a key, because this is God, so to speak. This is the place we cannot penetrate deeper than. From whence cometh we? Who knows? But who knows that science is confirming now, because in fact, existence leaps out of nothing. Science has shown us this. There was no particle, then there is. Not just that things get transferred from energy to matter, but that they come out of nothing. Now, when you start digesting this, when you start assimilating this, first of all, you see you can't control everything. You've got to just be tuned in. You're better off, rather than trying to control. The deepest knowing in you is going to come from nothing, is going to come from the elementary so-ness of the way it is, not this incredible genius that you carefully execute because you know it's that way. So where will we be as we loosen our grip on the control we have and open to the unknown from whence all springs? And all is everything, everyone, life force, the life force itself, which brings us into the oneness of everything. We are all of it. And he ends this beautiful section. I say no thingness or emptiness, but this only reveals the limits of language. We are here approaching an ultimate mystery, something that defeats our attempts to probe and investigate. And he's capitalized ultimate mystery. We are here approaching an ultimate mystery. There was no fireball, then the fireball erupted. The universe erupted. All that has existence erupted out of nothing. All of being erupted into shining existence. What I would like you to understand is that this plenary emptiness permeates you. You are more fecund emptiness than you are created particles. Now here we are. Science is giving us this primary identification so that we can feel ourselves confirmed by empirical knowing as part of this grand cosmos. We can see this by examining one of your atoms. If you take a single atom and make it as large as Yankee Stadium, it would consist almost entirely of empty space. The center of the atom, the nucleus, would be smaller than a baseball sitting out in center field. Did you know that? I didn't know that. The outer parts of the atom would be tiny gnats buzzing about at an altitude higher than any pop fly Babe Ruth ever hit. And between the baseball and the gnats, nothingness, all empty. You are more emptiness than anything else. Indeed, if all the space were taken out of you, you would be a million times smaller than the smallest grain of sand. But it's nice knowing we are this emptiness, for this emptiness is simultaneously the source of all being, you see? Youth asks, and this too has just been discovered? Yes. The way particles spontaneously leap into existence is a radical discovery in our own lifetimes. All of this is new within the scientific enterprise, breaking with traditions that go back to the beginning of science. Well, isn't this why we need a new story? Here we are with this awesome, more important than what Copernicus discovered, new pictures of how the universe is put together. And yet we don't have our new sense of self. This is why we need this new story. But from another point of view, Thomas goes on, we are arriving at an understanding that was deeply appreciated during the classical religious period of humanity. Ah, so we're getting reconnected with some insights to be had from the spiritual and the mystical realm. Science confirming spirit here. Thomas Aquinas and Meister Eckhart in the Middle Ages of Europe grasped intuitively that emptiness is the source of everything. They understood this realm of the not put together as the ultimate simplicity of the Godhead. This realization is echoed in the life and teaching of Buddha, who understood that all put together things arise from emptiness and exist inseparably with emptiness. The youth asks, do physics and Christianity and Buddhism say the same thing? Nothing that simplistic can be said. The situation is this. The creation story unfurling within the scientific enterprise provides the fundamental context, the fundamental arena of meaning for all the peoples of the earth. For the first time in human history, we can agree on the basic story of the galaxies, the stars, the planets, minerals, life forms, and human cultures. This story does not diminish the spiritual traditions of the classical or tribal period of human history. Rather, the story provides the proper setting for the teachings of all traditions, showing the true magnitude of their central truths. We are forging a cosmology that embraces humanity as a species, one that does not ignore the special cultural contributions of each continent, but that enhances these differences. Each tradition is irreplaceable. Not one can be reduced to any other. Each is vital to the work of the future. Each will flower beyond telling in fruitful interaction with the rest in the overall embracing story of the cosmos. During the first centuries of the modern period, such a situation was impossible. An antagonism existed between modern ways of knowing and traditional ways of life and belief. Perhaps this was necessary. The scientific enterprise needed austere isolation from both the animistic attitudes of the tribal period and the static cosmologies of classical civilizations. Scientific understanding was too new and too different to fit into previously existing modes of human awareness. It needed to establish its own canons, procedures, and experiments without reference to anything outside itself. The great wonder is that this empirical, rational journey of science should have any contact at all with spiritual traditions. But in our century, the mechanistic period of science opened out to include a science of mystery. Whoa, now here's, this is an important little chunk. The encounter with the ultimacy of no-thingness that is simultaneously a realm of generative potentiality. The dawning recognition that the universe and earth can be considered as living entities. The awareness that the human person, rather than a separate unit within the world, is the culminating presence of a billion-year process. And the realization that rather than having a universe filled with things, we are enveloped by a universe that is a single energetic event, a whole, a unified, multiform, and glorious outpouring of being. We do not want to forget that the division between science and religion has created sufferings of all kinds. We've paid a tremendous price to establish scientific activity, and only by remembering the suffering that this schizophrenic situation created can we celebrate the present. We have a vast, new, empirically grounded story of the universe, one that explodes beyond any previous telling of reality, one that encompasses all peoples because it is rooted in concrete experience. With this emerging story, we can continue our journey to our fullest destiny. What is our fullest destiny? To become love in human form. Now, this is a leap here that Brian takes, but that's what the book is going to develop. How science actually demonstrates that we are to be love in human form. Love? Asks youth. I thought we were talking about science and religion and emptiness. Yes, that's right. The journey out of emptiness is the creation of love. I'm confused. By what exactly? Well, by love. What do you mean by love? And that's the end of this setup section about creativity, primordial and pervasive, where we've now gotten linked into the generative force of the universe. We see that it's us. We see that we are on this evolutionary journey, not on a treadmill. And now Brian is going to develop for the rest of the book the idea of that our destiny is to become love in human form. And this is the most fascinating, imaginative, mystical voyage, all the while resting in hard science so that we can't shoot it down, and we can't think it's all make-believe, so to speak. So the grand reteller of the story of the universe, the grandest storyteller of all, is going to now tell us about allurement. But first I want to read to you, I want a little reinforcement here. I'm going to read what it says on the jacket of this book, which is really quite beautifully written, in case I missed it, so that you get the setup, so to speak. It says, communicating his ideas in the form of a classical dialogue, physicist Brian Swim crafts a fascinating exploration into the creative force in all matter, large and small. Cosmic allurement is the bond of all matter, is the dynamic principle that fuses the material plane, and we humans experience that force as love. Dr. Swim's explication of basic physical forces is mystical and ecstatic. It shocks the reader into a physiological, explosive awareness of the stuff of being. Yes, that's what I was trying to say. Swim writes, we awake to a universe permeated with love. We spend our time learning to become this love. Swim's inspirational view of matter is exceedingly relevant to the contemporary need to bless matter, to revision nature as being the breath and pulse of the Creator. Most significantly, Swim succeeds in describing the hugeness of the cosmos and the mystical interrelatedness of all matter. He is so grounded in love and relations himself, that is the truth, that the meaning and import of each individual is acutely emphasized. He makes the reader feel that his own life of love and creativity is what perpetuates the planet, quote, only if you pursue your destiny with the same extravagant devotion of the stars to their own destiny. So, onward to allurement.
Thank you for listening to the conversation.org making sense of these times. Now that you've heard from us, we'd love to hear from you. Click the feedback button on the show's webpage and share your thoughts. We'll be posting new shows approximately once a week. If you would like to be emailed when new shows are posted, let us know. This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org, dedicated to encouraging the awareness of ourselves as a one life and providing a meeting ground for those who share that awareness.